Forest and Rail.
He said it. In your view, is this a purely procedural or a procedural plus plan change? I just want to clarify from your perspective.
I guess it's a procedural plus. In terms of how I have proposed some of my drafting, there are environmental elements to the non-complying pathway, and there are some carryover environmental elements to the controlled activity matters of control.
And what was the basis of including those things in your latest iteration?
For including those in there?
Yeah.
With reference to the principles of the plan change, in relation to the difference between paper allocation and actual use, and with an eye to where we're practical, giving effect to the MPSFM, if there are ways to do that without compromising, I suppose, the streamlined nature or intent of the plan change.
Right. And so in terms of giving effect to the MPSFM 2020, in your view, do you think it's apparent in the Minister's direction that this be a concise, focused plan change that the Environment Court deals with to allow the Regional Council to get on and focus on the longer term plan change?
As I understand
longer term land and water plan.
As I understand it, yes, that this is an interim step to allow, essentially go back to this term, hold the line, and then allow effort to be put into the substantive, to giving effect to the MPSFM in a substantive form through the water and land plan, yes.
In your understanding of what's required to give effect to the MPSFM is quite an involved process to develop what values are held in each catchment, isn't it?
Correct.
And in terms of giving effect to that first order of the MPSFM of the health of the water, do you think it would be helpful and advantageous to be able to look at as much of the catchment as possible and without the constraints of allocations in place?
I'm sorry, can you say that question again?
Sorry.
In terms of tier one of the
MPSFM, considering the health of the river as a whole, do you think it is useful and advantageous to be able to look at as much of the catchment as possible with as fewer constraints as possible, such as already allocated water?
I don't understand the question.
Sorry. My question is basically getting at saying, in order to think of the health of the river as a whole, if you have a constraint of an allocation for a longer term period of, say, 35 years, that already locks up a significant amount, or could lock up a significant amount of water, that then gives you fewer options in terms of giving effect to that tier one priority for a longer period of time, if that makes sense.
It does, but has this not already been covered by Mr. Moore's questioning? And I also didn't think, as a matter of principle, this witness was against or was saying anything other than, perhaps with the exception of hydro and drink water, that there should be anything more than 6 years. I think he was generally in favour of 6 years. Is that not so?
That's correct.
Yeah. That's correct. I guess I'm just trying to clarify one aspect that I think Mr. Moore didn't necessarily cover in terms of being able to allow the Regional Council, in order to look at that wider Tier 1 principle, to have as to be able to look at that as a whole, and that imposing a 35-year consent would frustrate the ability of the council to do that, just to clarify that point, to try and surmise where Mr. Moore was going. That's kind of where my question is getting at, but I feel like it's largely been covered. Yeah, all right, we'll leave it there then.
Okay, thank you. Could Mr. Welsh, trustpayer?
Good afternoon, Ms. Denzel.
Good afternoon.
I'm going to cover with you some themes that I wasn't going to cover with you when I prepared my cross-examination. And first of all, can I confirm that the supplementary brief that you have, well, which has been the focus of today's proceedings, was prepared in response to an amended or recommended set of changes by Mr. De Pelsmaker, which better aligned with the mandate of his client, and you responded to in fairly short order?
That's correct.
Yes, and you would accept that there may be issues of drafting, but you've put forward some changes or recommendations to Plan Change 7 that currently sits before this court in response to matters that are still missing or haven't been given full consideration. Is that fair?
Yeah, we responded quickly to the changes and acknowledged that the drafting may not be perfect.
Yes.
Nor might the suite of information out there.
Yes. So I'm not going to get into the weeds with you on the individual provisions, given that, but as I say, cover some themes. Now, the first theme I want to cover is the application of the renewable national policy statement on renewable electricity generation. And my friend Mr. Moore essentially put to you, based on the words in the preamble, that the REG MPS provides a framework for electricity by allowing consents to be granted for deemed permits that relate to hydroelectricity. Put it a bit more eloquently than that, but that was his essential thesis to you, that it provides a framework.
Yeah, I acknowledge it provides a framework. Yeah.
And he put to you that, based on the preamble, the MPS does not have application when considering allocation issues. Do you recall him putting that to you?
Yes, he did.
And you referenced, you said, I think there's some case law context for that.
Correct.
And he didn't ask you what that case law context was, so I will. Mr. Moore's opening submissions referenced or quoted in part, but not in full, the decision of Carter Holt Harvey and Waikato Regional Council. Does that case ring any bells with you?
Yes, it does. The details don't, but the case does.
And in that case, the Environment Court found that the statement in the preamble should not be read as excluding the ability of regional councils to make freshwater allocation decisions which reflect the importance of renewable energy activities. Do you recall reading that in that case?
Look, I honestly... I remember the theme, the details, as I say. I don't recall it in detail.
Right. But in that case, the court went on to say that even if they were wrong in that regard, that it considered as a precaution or as a cautionary approach to consider the policy statement's provisions which reflect and give strong guidance to the relevant statutory provisions contained in Part 2. Does that sound right, or accord with your...
It sounds familiar, yes.
Yeah, so in that case, the court found that even in allocation decisions, the RPS may be relevant. So I want to take you to the RPS and step you through some of those provisions.
Is that a legal submission or is that a question to this witness? Because the witness didn't answer, so I don't even know whether the witness is fully familiar with the case.
Well, I think the witness confirmed he's aware of the case.
That's all he's confirmed. He's not aware of the detail. He also said that.
Yes.
So what was your last? What was the point of your last question?
What was the point? Oh, I could have added, do you recall that? And he could have said, didn't. But that's fine, Mum. I'll move on.
Move on, yeah.
So I'm going to put to you the provisions of some of the policies in respect of the RPS, the MPS, and have you comment upon those. If you have those in front of you there, in the, I think it's tab 7, common bundle 813.
I think it's been removed again, sorry.
I'm going off memory, Madam Registrar, that it was tab 7, but it's at common bundle 813. And Ms. Nenzo, I want to take you to page 4 of that document with the MPS. And that, does it not, sets out that it is a matter of national significance to which this MPS applies, the need to develop, operate and maintain and upgrade renewable electricity generation activities throughout New Zealand.
Yes, correct.
Yes. And the objective of the MPS is to recognise the national significance of renewable electricity generation by providing for its development, operation and maintenance, etc., so as to meet the nation's targets for renewable electricity generation. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And are you aware that the current national target for renewable electricity generation is 100% renewable by 2030?
That's correct.
And in policy A, decision makers shall. It's directive language, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yes. Directive.
Decision makers shall recognise and provide for the national significance of renewable electricity generation activities. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And in policy E2, specifically around hydro, that requires regional policy statements and regional plans and district plans shall include objectives, policies and methods, including rules within the plans, to provide for the development, operation, maintenance and upgrading of new and existing hydroelectricity activities. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And Plan Change 7 does not contain such rules or policies, does it?
Not in any specific sense.
No, and other than the some provisions specifically around Waitaki, I think the consensus is neither does the operative regional plan.
As I understand and recall, that's right.
Yes. And that's despite the fact that within the implementation period in H, policy H2, Otago Regional Council was required to do so some 10 years ago, wasn't it?
I can't see direct reference to the date, but I see that there is some discussion about the timing.
A considerable number of years, shall we just settle on that? It was required to do that.
In policy H2?
H2, yes, ma'am.
But where are you referring to when you get to 10 years? Sorry, I can't see it either. So just direct me to is it A or B or the preamble or what?
Well, ma'am, where a regional policy yeah. statement already provides for these policies, which most probably did not at that stage. It was within 24 months of doing so, of 2011, so 2013. or in B, where there's a change to the regional policy statement, then within 12 months of that becoming operative. So I might have overestimated the 12 years, but the short point is, Mr. Ensor, there has been a considerable period since the passage of this MPS in 2011, and there's still a policy vacuum in the regional plan sense in Otago, despite that passage of the MPS.
Yeah, from my recollection of the operative plan, yes.
Yes, and your suggestions in Plan Change 7 were aimed at trying to fill some of that vacuum.
It was recognising that that there was some direction, as discussed with Mr. Moore earlier, and that that there was an opportunity in Plan Change 7 to assist in giving effect to that direction.
And when you reflect on the policies and matters of national importance that I've taken you through, do you believe that Parliament had in mind, when it passed the MPS, something along the lines of regional councils simply don't make hydro a prohibited activity, just give it a framework for securing consent, and that is sufficient?
I think the language would suggest that it would be stronger than that.
Yes. Now, Mr. Moore.
Just a point of clarification for my friend's question. I don't believe Parliament did have anything in mind, because Parliament didn't make the MPS for renewable energy generation.
That was what a Board of Inquiry type structure, wasn't it?
It's a subordinate statutory instrument, ma'am. So it's a minor point, but an important one.
Yeah, I mean, my recollection, and I haven't dealt with the MPS for renewables for at least 2 years, but no, it's not. It's subordinate legislation, but it's not legislation which was passed by an Act of Parliament. It's come through another vehicle. Is that the point that you were getting?
That my friend's point is fair, and I accept that, and we can substitute Parliament for Board of Inquiry or Minister for that matter, but the short point of...
Well, I don't even know if it was the Minister. I thought Royden Somerville was involved in this at some stage on a board and made... Yes. I don't know whether he made a decision or recommendations.
A recommendation. Yeah. And it would have gone to an officials committee, and it could have been considerably changed before it ended up as an MPS, as occurred with the NZ CPS process at the same similar time.
Forgive me, ma'am. The purpose of my question was simply that it's a very difficult question to pose to a witness as to what the decision-maker had in mind, given the opaqueness of the decision-making process to do with this instrument.
That's a fair point.
I'll rephrase my question, ma'am.
Mr. Ensor, having gone through the national matters of national significance and the policies, do you think simply ensuring that hydro can apply for a resource consent, like any other use, sufficiently gives effect to that MPS?
I mean, my reading of the MPS is that it is directive for a reason, and that it highlights the importance of, in this case, it would be water abstraction for that purpose. Yes, so there's a level of a direction in that document.
Yes, beyond providing for an ability to apply for a resource consent.
Correct.
Yes, and you would agree that under section 66(1)(EA), a regional council must prepare and change any regional plan in accordance with a national policy statement. You're aware of that?
Yes.
Yes, and that would include the REG National Policy Statement, wouldn't it?
It would.
Yes, and under Section 66, one's not free to pick and choose which MPS it gives effect to, is it?
No, there's no such direction as I'm aware through there.
No. Mr. Moore put to you on a number of occasions propositions around a deemed permit holder that operates hydro seeking 35-year rollover replacement consents. Have you read Trustpower's submission and evidence?
I have, and it's starting to get into the past somewhat now. But yes.
Do you recall the relief in respect of duration in Trustpower's submission of seeking an expiry date of May 2038?
Yes, I do recall yes. that.
And that's considerably shorter than a 35-year term, isn't it?
It is.
And the logic for that is to align it to the scheme within which these deemed permits are functionally integrated, being the Waipori scheme. You recall that?
I do recall that, yes.
And that alignment would then allow a decision maker to undertake a full integrated management decision of the Waipori scheme in its totality, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would.
Now, one of the reasons that the Minister called in and directed this plan change to this court is because of the relationship with the MPS REG. Do you recall that as one of the Minister's reasons for his decision to call in this plan change?
Sorry, not directly. All apologies.
My friend Ms. Baker Galloway put to you some objectives and policies from the RPS and took you through those. Do you have those still available in front of you?
I'm not sure I do, sorry.
And I think it's in Common Bundle 568. What would that be? Tab 4? Tab 3. Now, at Ms. Denzel, at Common Bundle page 568 or page 63 of the RPS, you'll find policy 4.4.1.
Yes, I have that.
Yes, and I don't think this policy was put to you by Ms. Baker Galloway. And that policy is to provide for renewable electricity activities by all of the following. Recognising the benefits associated with those activities. See that?
Yes.
Recognising the functional needs of those activities. In B.
Yes.
And in C, recognising the importance of the resource needs of those activities.
Yes.
And D and E continues in respect of the efficient use of those structures or facilities and matters of development of potential sites. My point is, Mr. Ensor, in providing a pathway for hydro with a longer term consent, do you consider that that is consistent with policy 4.4.1 and the policy direction that gives the decision maker in respect to Plan Change 7?
Sorry, could you just reframe that question, the last part of that?
Do you accept that under policy 4.4.1, matters that it contains, the benefits of hydroelectricity are to be recognised?
Yes.
And one of the ways that you have tried to recognise that and give effect to the policy directions is to provide a pathway for hydro, which provides for a longer term consent.
Yes, correct.
And if you turn the page to Common Bundle 563, there's additional policy direction there on protecting existing hydroelectricity, isn't there?
Yes, there is.
and recognising the national or regional significance of renewable electricity. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yes. Now, Ms. Denzel,
what's your question about that?
Pardon?
Sorry, now that we've established there's a policy in the RPS, what was your question about it?
Oh, my question was, well, it wasn't put to Ms. Denzel, so I wanted the record to record that there is such a policy.
So, okay, so the record reflects that there is this policy?
Yes.
And there's no other relevance?
Sorry?
Yeah, where are you going with it?
Well, my point then was to recognise that that policy relates to protecting existing hydro or renewable electricity generation, ma'am, which wasn't put to the witness before.
All right. Anyway. Is there something in what this witness has said that would cut across this in terms of protecting your output? Duration is different from output, isn't it?
Ma'am, I was simply putting the full spectrum of relevant policies to this witness, which my friend Ms. Baker-Galloway didn't do.
Would you want to ask him to comment on it? Or not?
I'm happy if he wishes to comment on those
policies.
I'm just
wondering where you're going. It's not getting us anywhere. I mean, I know you'll have evidence which will have all of this in, and we will read it all. But getting witnesses just to confirm that there are policies doesn't take or advance the Trustpower case. For example, I would have thought a good question in relation to policy 4.1, rather than the question that you asked, was whether or not a six-year duration, or what's the duration you're seeking for your...
Well, it's down to 17 and a half, ma'am, as this process continues.
I beg your pardon?
I said it's down to 17 and a half years.
What does that mean?
We've set, well, the relief sought a date of May 2038. So when Trustpower filed the submission, that was circa 18 years, and it's now been reduced down to 17 and a half years to get to that time frame.
Is that a complaint about this process?
No, I'm not complaining at all, ma'am.
All right.
If I said if I stuck with 18 years, that's longer than the period Trustpower actually seeks. It seeks a term to align with its existing scheme, which is May 2038.
And the existing scheme, what expires there?
What expires, sorry?
Yeah, what expires? What expires at 2038?
All the resource consents that relate to the operation of the Waipori Hydroelectric Power Scheme and the deep stream enhancement to that scheme. So everything in Waipori...
Right, OK. So I would have thought the better question was, in terms of implementing Objective 4.4 and Policy 4.4.1, and there may be other objectives and policies, is it a better outcome under Plan Change 7 for there to be a six-year consent than the 2038 or 18-year, 17-year duration as proposed by Trustpower, and then to support the witness to support his answer with a view. And, of course, that would also bring into play the rest of the matters which are relevant under the NPS. So, I mean, I am actually really interested in that. What's the better outcome and why?
Yes, ma'am. All right, I'll put that question. I did put a similar question around the NPS, but I'll ask Mr. Ensor.
I don't want to trouble you. No, you're not troubling me at all, ma'am. What is the better outcome relative to the objectives under the NPS REG and the NPS for freshwater management, a six-year duration or a duration expiring 2038 to coincide with other permits associated with the Waipori and deep stream schemes? And, you know, you'll have to consider both NPSs, and if you could give us your answer and why.
Look, I think in terms of the NPS REG, that there is a relatively directive policy in terms of providing for it. And I see that there is, in terms of the NPS FM, there is value in terms of, and I think it's policy 3, in terms of a sort of an integrated management approach to water. From a practical sense, it doesn't make the job any easier giving effect to the MPSFM if a major user is having to consent a scheme on a piecemeal basis, and whether there's another mechanism that could be done, I'm not sure. But it would seem to me to recognise the benefits that the hydro electricity generation activity provides, to do that through aligning durations and having the scheme considered as a whole would also assist with the MPSFM delivery.
So your answer is a better outcome might be to align the water permit duration with the duration of the Manapouri and Deep scheme. Waipori and other deeps and the Deep scheme.
In terms of an integrated freshwater management approach.
To what extent is that approach actually reflected in this region, insofar as under this water plan, it appears that the water plan doesn't endeavour to align resource consents. Where multiple resource consents are required in relation to a particular activity, the plan is not driving an integrated management approach.
The plan change isn't?
Well, no, the plan, well, operative plan.
Operative plan, no, the operative plan isn't necessarily either, no.
No.
No, and I guess this is one opportunity. There's possibly
okay.
Others.
All right, thank you for that. Carry on.
Thank you, Mum. Ms. Denzel, in your supplementary brief, you actually provided two options for providing an exception for hydro and drinking water, and only the second has been the subject of questioning from my friends. If I describe it this way, the cleaner, explicit and more simple version is contained in your paragraph 13. Is that right?
Sorry, I'll just find that. Correct.
And that cleaner, simpler, explicit version may avoid some of the particular drafting issues that you've encountered with Mr. Moore and my other friends in respect of which arise in respect of the other option.
Essentially by stripping out any thresholds that you're either in or you're out.
Yes.
So I agree, it's very black and white.
Yes, thank you. In terms of...
Can you just take me back to that? I missed the reference.
Sorry, Mark. Commissioner, it's at 13, paragraph 13 of Mr. Ensor's supplementary. He actually sets out two options but doesn't include both of them in the track changes.
So paragraph
13 at page 4 of Ms. Ensor's supplementary.
OK, so that's the italicised, for example.
Yes.
Is that what you're referring to? Thank you.
Yes.
I've caught up now.
Yes, no, thank you. And Ms. Ensor, as I read your recommended changes, if a hydro application could not meet the entry thresholds or entry conditions under the controlled activity rule for whatever reason, and one of those reasons may be lack of data, as Mr. Moore put to you, it would still remain a non-complying activity, would it not, under your changes?
You mean the changes here in paragraph 13?
Well, under either or, really, or it would, if it doesn't meet a controlled activity standard.
Yes, that's right. Yes. Without another rule in place, as discussed earlier, yes.
Yes. And you ascribe to the general planning consensus that passing through the second gateway test of 104D for a non-complying activity for the relevant policy is near on impossible, or at least very challenging.
Which policy, sorry?
Policy 10.3.3 2, I think, or 10.2.3 it is.
Sorry, which version?
Well, I'm working off...
Are you referring to Mr. Placemaker's version? Yes, so in relation to... Well, I'm looking at Appendix 1, the Appendix 1 version, although I understand they take us to the same place. But, yes, my view is that it's very explicit, avoid granting unless...
Yes. And I suppose I'll cut to the chase. If, as Ms. Stiles recommends in her evidence, that hydro is dealt with as a discretionary activity instead of a non-complying activity, the consent authority would still retain full discretion to approve or decline that application, doesn't it?
They would retain that discretion, yes.
And it would have the full range of relevant matters to consider?
Correct.
And it could impose the full range of relevant or lawful, I should say, resource consent conditions?
Yes, correct.
Yes. And I suppose what, if that is the case, what benefit in respect of a activity that has a national policy direction that it's a matter of national significance, do you see it retaining a non-complying status as opposed to the discretionary status?
I guess the benefit is in terms of maintaining the intent of the plan change and identifying, well, I guess as it's been drafted in my changes, keeping all of the exemptions in one spot. So it's either you're either controlled or you're an exemption for whatever reason, and you're dealt with in that way. Aside from the gateway test itself, which may provide some level of it might weed out certain applications, but otherwise everything it does get considered as if it was with full discretion as you've described. So that I guess the benefit is that there's a relatively strong signal generally, but by providing a pathway for hydro, for example, in this non-complying rule, you are bypassing it, I guess, that sort of extra level of that extra test.
Well, one could take the view that making the activity non-complying would suggest to the decision maker, perhaps, that the application is not appropriate. But given your comments around the national policy direction for hydro, do you think that would be a fair position for the decision maker to reach?
In terms of general appropriateness, I'm not sure, but in the context of this plan change, which is supposed to be, an interim generally, I think that's where the difference lies. It's we're looking at the significance of the activity amongst all activities subject to an interim regime. If that makes sense.
Yes, thank you. Now, I just want to cover one other matter with you, and that's the policy that I think has received very little attention to date, and that's policy 10A2.2, and I'm looking at, again, Mr. De Pelsmaker's 14 March version. And that relates, does it not, to new consents, so not deemed permits and not replacement consents, which expire by 31 December 2025. So anything else? Is that correct?
Yes, that's what I understand. Yes.
And you haven't recommended a similar exemption for hydro or drinking water in that provision, have you?
No, I haven't.
Is there a reason for that?
I guess my expectation is that would be addressed through the... where it arose, through the... ideally through the new plan. I appreciate that there might be a circumstance where some reason might arise over the next 6 years or so to make an application, but I guess my focus has been on the renewal process.
Right. Mr. Balsmaker describes one of the goals of Plan Change 7 is to discourage further investment in water-related sectors. Would you be concerned, given the national direction around hydro, with that discouragement remaining in this plan?
I think potentially in the context of new water, with the impending Part 3 MPS process, I would say that, you know, new allocation and new investment on the back of that should be looked at pretty cautiously.
Okay. Can you help me? Other than the deemed permits, which are a peculiarity of this part of the country, and perhaps the Galaxids, what's unique with Otago as it grapples to deliver and give effect to the MPS freshwater management that doesn't apply to other regional councils that find themselves with older regional plans?
Off the top of my head, the deemed permits and the the complexity and peculiarity of that is sort of the key issue, and that includes how the environment is adapted to that and on subsequent ecological or environmental
But
status.
Other than that...
But otherwise, there's nothing that jumps to mind. But
no, because this policy doesn't relate to the deemed permits. It relates to all other new future permits. So nothing that jumps to mind. And would you agree that it would have been relatively simple to insert in the implementation of the MPS a direction that all councils shall limit consent durations for new activities to 6 years while they grapple and implement the MPS?
I'm not sure about simple.
But they could have included that.
Shall we move this on? Because it's not going to help me, that proposition as to what the decision makers there could or could not have included, and whether they would or would not have included a six-year duration. I understand the point that you're making at 10 regarding policy 10A2.2. I have read Ms. Stiles' evidence in relation to that. I am not assisted by this line of examination.
Well, I'm sorry about that, ma'am. There's no direction in the MPS or the RMA in respect of limiting consents to a six-year term, is there?
Not that I'm aware of.
Thank
no.
you. That's all enough.
Mr. Page.
The TAs in the hope that I may not need to, ma'am.
Thank you. Ms. Irving.
Good afternoon, Mr. Ensor.
Good afternoon.
I just have a couple of, I suppose, topics to talk through with you relating to the territorial authority interests. The first relates to drinking water and how that term, I suppose, applies in the context of the MPSFM, and then what it encompasses in a practical sense. Now, my understanding of the second order priority in the MPSFM is it's about the health needs of people. Do you agree with that?
Yes. Yep.
And one example of that that is identified in the MPSFM is drinking water.
Yes, there's one example when it's drinking water.
So there's uses of water or other matters that are broader than drinking water that would fall within the ambit of the health needs of people?
Yes, I'm sure there are. I guess with the example given, it's the difference between sort of drinking water, which is fairly fundamental to human existence, does sort of set the bar relatively high with its example. We can probably go without a shower for some time and make alternative sanitary arrangements, but drinking water is necessary.
And I think in response to a question from one of my friends, and I don't recall which one it was now, but you referred to the national planning standards and the definition of drinking water in terms of what you understand that term to mean.
Correct.
And do you have that definition to hand?
Possibly.
Which bundle?
I don't think the planning standards are in the bundle from memory.
I may have included it as a footnote, but I can't quite recall now. Sorry.
So if I Google it, what would I be looking for?
Yeah, if you, I went through that exercise. If you Google the just national planning standards. And
are you looking for a definition?
Yes, so page 56 of the document, Your Honour. I can read it to you if that would help.
Yeah, sorry, I thought I may have included it as a footnote, but I haven't.
So, drinking water means water intended to be used for human consumption and includes water intended to be used for food preparation, utensil washing, and oral or other personal hygiene. So it isn't just water that gets consumed by people, is it?
No, used directly by people there too.
And it's interesting that it is intended for those range of purposes, isn't it? The definition doesn't rely on the water being used for those purposes, does it?
I think maybe you could derive that from it. There's a clear intention. It may be that there is an unintended use, but the clear intention is that it's used for those purposes.
Yes. So if we think about that in terms of how councils may operate their drinking water infrastructure. They take water from a waterway, convey it to a treatment station. It is treated to drinking water standards and distributed. Now, I'd put it to you that water is intended for human consumption. Would you agree with that?
That's one of the intended uses.
Yes. And so any water in that system is drinking water, isn't it?
Only if used as such.
But that isn't what definition says, is it? It's water intended to be used for human consumption, not water that is consumed by humans.
I guess it depends on what part of the system you're referring to it at. If we're talking about it coming out the tap at a household, then there's a clear intention that it will be used for the matters described. Treated to drinking water quality at the treatment plant is something else.
Mm. What about the water that might come out of the tap, say in my office? Commercial premises, but that water is to be drunk. Correct?
Yes.
I'd like to move on to the non-complying rule in your supplementary evidence, if I can, please. And I just want to work through the practicality of that, the operation of that rule when we're dealing with drinking water takes and catchments that have a whole lot of other water permits in them that are likely to, or that may be operating under the more procedural controlled activity pathway.
You mean the controlled activity pathway or something else?
The controlled activity pathway, yeah. So, as I understand your proposed, it's actually, sorry, your policy 10A23, which is on, we go over to page 2 of your appendix. You provide a sort of carve out, for lack of a better word, for activities for the supply of drinking water, and you also require them to meet the provisions of policy 10A23, 1A through C. Correct?
Yes, that's correct.
So where we have takes, existing takes for drinking water that don't have an existing residual flow or minimum flow, you intended, and I think questions from my friends, Mr. Moore, identified some challenges with the drafting.
But I'd agree.
How I had interpreted it was that you essentially were looking for applications for longer terms to take some steps towards the matters that you'd identified in Chapter C. So an expectation that they would propose residual flows or minimum flows to help protect habitat and enhance the various values you identified there.
Correct.
And what I was interested to test with you is when we have a small number of takes within a catchment captured by this provision, whether or not that is going to create a real challenge for those water users, because they are not the only ones influencing flows in the water body that they're taking water from. And so if I perhaps put a hypothetical to you, or one that's discussed in the evidence actually for the Central Otago District Council, they have a take from the Manaherikia River. And if they sought to renew that permit under your proposed framework here, your expectation would be that they have a residual flow on that take past their intake, correct?
Yes, if they want access to the long duration.
Yes. But in the Manaherikia, there are, of course, many other permits, including big intakes from the main stem, that are going to be influencing how much water is in the Manaherikia River, aren't there?
Potentially, yes.
Mm. And those permits, if they have been rolled over under the controlled activity rule, won't have residual flow or minimum flow conditions on them, will they? or unless the permits already did.
Unless they already had them.
Yeah. And so permit holders under, or drinking water permit holders under your rule may well be prevented from exercising their consents because of the effect of those other takes on flows in the river, wouldn't they?
Permit holders under which rule? Sorry, which permit holders are you talking about now?
So the drinking water permit holders.
So this is a question in relation to drinking water only, because I thought we might have been moving off from that.
Yes, no, not, just in relation to the drinking water permits that can avail themselves of this carve-out.
Yeah, this is the drinking water carve-out.
Yes.
Yep. Okay.
Yes, so they have an obligation to comply with a residual flow.
Yep, if there is one.
Yes, well, or if they have, through Clause C of Mr. Ensor's policy.
If there's one imposed.
Yes.
And then you were, what was your next question? If there's one, if you have to go via Clause C.
Yes.
And you are one of very few, presumably, because you're a territorial authority in the main. If you're one of very few permit applicants, is the question then how does this all rub along with, you know, that great farming body which is out there?
Yes, so we could end up in the situation where the drinking water permits are subject to a residual flow and the exercise of their permit will be tied to that, but that those permit holders have very little control over how much water is coming through the waterway to them. So the residual flow, in essence, could be breached as a result of the exercise of the replacement permits that have been rolled over pursuant to the controlled activity rule.
Okay, so that's the proposition.
Yes.
I suppose the first thing is, does Mr. Ensor agree that that could be a fact scenario which might emerge under the controlled activity rule and the non-complying rule, I guess it is?
The combination of them.
Yeah.
Yes.
I guess it is a possibility. I think there's an opportunity to rectify it in terms of how that residual flow is expressed and whether it involves sort of an upstream, downstream measure or some other mechanism. But, I can see the challenge. If there's no water coming in, then you can't let any below your intake.
Yes.
But I think you could set a residual flow that considers that matter.
So you think that would be important to make sure that those drinking water users actually had access to water when they needed it?
I'm not sure about access to water, but possibly in terms of being physically able to demonstrate compliance with a residual flow, it would be useful.
Okay.
Yes, I guess whether there's water available to take is another issue.
Yes. Yeah.
As if we needed more issues to add to the mix.
Well, bring it on. But I think the point that you're making, Ms. Irving, is that the consumption of drinking water, which is needed to sustain human life at least, and it may be woolly around the edges where that stops and starts, but anyway, drinking water to sustain human life has a higher priority under the NPS objective than, say, the use of water for agricultural activities or farming activities. So if farming, if you like, is setting the pattern for residual flows or even minimum flows for a catchment, which might work under their flow sharing agreements, but not necessarily TAs are involved in the territorial authorities are involved in their flow sharing agreements, then what is there going to be any water left for people, for humans to consume? Yeah, I get what you're getting at. I don't know what your answer to that is, though.
Yeah, well, I think it was really in the interim where... If we assume that the controlled activity pathway were to get traction and a whole lot of those agricultural permits, for lack of a better term, were to be rolled over largely without residual flow or minimum flow conditions, then that would dictate potentially the ability for the drinking water permit holder to comply with a residual flow condition that had enabled them to get a longer term consent.
Why do you think largely without minimum flows or residual flows? Because into that mix then comes the potential, and at this stage it's not adequately explored, the potential for the water sharing agreements to come down in a way which at least provides for farming interests. It's not same as territorial interests, not at all.
Well, I think I'm dealing with Mr. Ensor's supplementary, which hasn't had an opportunity to consider the flow sharing conversation that we've been having in the last sort of 24 hours. So I think there's potential that may overcome the issue that I'm identifying.
There's also potential that it may not. I thought that's where you were going. Actually, it might not. I mean,
yes.
Those flow sharing agreements as between primary water users.
Yes, well, I think to be fair, the territorial authorities can be participants in those where they have takes within the catchment. So that is not to say that those wouldn't provide an avenue to address the concern.
Mm.
But my question was more that if we do end up with that six-year controlled activity rollover, how does that dovetail with an obligation for the drinking water permits to meet a higher standard? And would it be more appropriate for, in that interim 6 years, for for there to be a review, I suppose, to impose the residual flow and minimum flow limits?
What's the higher standard you're referring to specifically?
Well, if they were to apply under this policy in order to obtain a longer-term consent, it's my understanding that they'd need to demonstrate that they were enhancing the environment. That was the function of Mr. Ensor's paragraph C. So they would end up with some form of residual flow or minimum flow condition on their longer-term permit. And I was interested in exploring how that fits in a catchment where the vast majority of water users are not going to be subject to that type of control.
Understood.
There's fish hooks wherever we turn, I think.
Yes, there are. Okay. Oh, sorry, I know where you're going, and it's important. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, so I suppose, Mr. Ensor, have you considered the implications of imposing that type of residual flow on drinking water standards when the broader water use within the catchment will be driving flows in the waterways that are affected?
Not specifically, but I guess I'd like to acknowledge that it's only in relation to longer durations, and if a six-year consent was sought, for example, under the controlled activity rule, then the same restrictions would apply. They would not apply. Whether that gets you out of trouble, I'm not sure.
Hmm. Well, I think you will have read the evidence on behalf of the territorial authorities, which identified the challenges that a short-term consenting regime presents.
Yes.
And so in that sense, we're trying to find a solution that's going to cater for those challenges, aren't we?
Yes, I understand that.
I don't have any further questions, Your Honour.
All right, thank you. Mr. Page.
I've got
conscious that you're going to rise in 9 minutes, ma'am.
Yes, I am, precisely.
And I know that the witness needs to get on a plane tonight, and you probably have questions for him.
We have a few, and we do need to rise at nine. Whether the witness needs to be on a plane tonight is a different question, because we're not going to finish tonight, unfortunately.
Yes. Well, I was going to suggest that my questions are few, but can just as easily be made as submissions, probably, and so I'm happy to forego asking the questions if the court is able to get the witness released this evening.
Okay, so you don't need them for questions, because you know, I don't want you giving evidence from the bar.
No, well, I mean, the questions I have are really around the exceptions that the witness has designed into the non-complying framework relating to matters germane to an MPS, and whether the same treatment might be given to NPS matters under the NPS FM 2020. Now, if you wish, if that's...
That's really lost me. I thought I got a lot of cross-examination out of Mr. Moore about those exceptions and can they work or not work. There's a big question mark now over those.
Yes, and so I think we've got some way to go before we're actually settled on what purpose the non-complying activity rule serves. So I'm not sure that chasing the witness around in circles at the moment actually helps.
It may not. One of the things that we keep on coming back to is, you know, what is the objective here? Mm. It doesn't help us if the minister has not made a submission on the objective, you know, to have planning evidence that kind of goes, not looking at that, but, you know, we're going to be doing these other things under policy, when actually the outcomes, they needed to be determined in the objective.
Yeah.
You know, that's the elephant in the room. Is what is this objective? And we're not here yet. I think, Mr. Enzor, I think you accept that is the elephant in the room. It's the objective, and albeit that the Minister hasn't commented upon that, that is still the elephant in the room, and your policies aren't responding to an objective. Would that be fair?
Yes, I think that'd be fair.
Well, I mean, I have a sense that there's an awkward dynamic developed today where the Minister and the Regional Council are, in fact, running in opposite directions. And it's a little odd...
I'm not sure that is so. I don't think that is so. But, you know, none of this is easy. You're trying to unpack and repackage a 100-year-old problem with deemed permits, at least. That's one of the things that you're doing here.
Yes, that's fair. Okay. In any case, I'm happy to...
You're happy to forego. Yeah. All right. Any re-examination?
Yes, Mum, I did. Looking at the clock and wondering...
Can we hold the witness over till tomorrow? Is it possible to catch a plane tomorrow?
No, I'd really... Mr. Enzor is going to be driving through the night to Rotorua.
Well, I'll just have to confer with my friends.
We can, of course, recall him.
Fine, 5:15. You can continue.
Thank you.
Yep.
I'll be very quick.
Sorry, Mr. Page. Does that mean you would have taken a few moments?
No.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mr. Enzor. A number of the questions that you've been asked this afternoon from my friends relate to hydroelectricity in one form or another. And without chasing our way back through the National Policy Statement on renewable electricity generation, a very straightforward question. If we remove water from hydroelectric generation and its consideration under the NPS, what is it exactly that we're protecting?
You mean NPS fresh water?
Yes, the NPS. No.
NPS reg?
The NPS reg.
Okay.
Just the infrastructure, whatever may be sitting in and around water bodies.
Thank you. And secondly, along the same lines, really, Mr. Moore, Ms. Baker-Galloway, amongst others, asked you questions around hydro takes and particularly about locking in consents for long duration if water is allocated for hydro use, very much in the context of how that would prevent water being available for use for other purposes or to others. And my question is this: are all hydro takes consumptive?
No, they're not. Some are what would be considered non-consumptive.
Is your answer it depends whether they're consumptive or non-consumptive, and it depends on the definition in the water plan? Is that what you're getting at? I wasn't sure.
Yes, some are consumptive and some are not. Okay. And yes, it would depend on that definition whether the take would meet that or not.
Oh. And if a water take meets the definition of non-consumptive, what does that mean in terms of its availability for others to use after it's been used for hydro?
It's available for use.
And thirdly, Ms Lennon asked you some questions about the priority order in the NPS freshwater management, again picking up on matters of renewable generation, and pointed out, I think, that renewable generation or electricity generation of any kind is a lower order matter under the NPS FM. In the context of putting to you some questions around getting the sequencing right in terms of addressing to Manawa Tawai and looking to the needs of the water body as the NPS FM requires us to do. Now, again, bearing in mind the questions that you've had around hydro takes and the NPS REG, what's your understanding of the status of one national policy statement as against another?
I understand that they're on equal footing.
I'm sorry, can you say that again?
On equal footing,
On equal footing. And lastly, you've been taken quite forensically by Mr. Moore through the drafting that you produced last week in response to Mr. de Pelsmaker's changed position. And he took you through provision by provision, particularly in relation to the non-complying policy that you had proposed. Just stepping back from that and the particular detail of the drafting, can you simply explain why you added the redlined material that you did effectively onto the end of where Mr. de Pelsmaker's version of the non-complying policy stopped?
In terms of, I think it's C through, clause C, the intention behind that is to provide a series of thresholds for activities that are seeking to access longer durations to meet, which has an eye on, first and foremost, the health and well-being of the water body, and then other matters besides. And the intent of that is to make the non-complying pathway more stringent and apply to, for want of a better term, true exceptions.
Thank you, ma'am. Thank you, Mr. Rintoul.
Have you got any questions?
Just one, and the follow-up, we talked about the status of one NPS versus another and your understanding that they're on an equal footing. And maybe on an equal footing, but when you dig into them, isn't it like any planning document? Some elements are perhaps more directive than others. Some can be reconciled. Some may not be able to be reconciled.
Yes, I think that's a fair comment. the starting point is the same, but as you delve into them, there may be trade-offs isn't probably quite the right word, but you know what I'm saying. You'll need to look carefully at what's being achieved and evaluate things next to each other.
So in your answers in relation to the MPS reg, for example, have you factored that in?
Yes, I have, and I guess while acknowledging the drafting challenges that might exist, I've tried to bring forward some of the National Policy Statement for Fresh Water elements directly into the rule, into the policy, so they are considered alongside the exemption for hydro, for example, in a more direct or certain way, as opposed to just a wider consideration at section 104 1B.
Okay, thank you.
Probably just one question, coming back to this drinking water issue and the fact that the water is taken and used for other purposes. Had you turned your mind to how that might be dealt with?
Not in any great detail. I mean, I recognise that there might be some challenges at the far end of a pipe. And really my inclusion of drinking water in terms of the definition was reasonably deliberate, because it was clearer to me in the MPSFM that would have a higher status than other potential users, and that it could end up being confused or could confuse the situation as to what was a true exemption. Or it may mean that activities that, you know, an abstraction that has very little drinking water and mostly dairy shed water, for example, makes it through, where that really wasn't the intention as I saw it in the MPS FM in terms of the priority it gives it.
So difficult question.
Yeah, no, I think it's a difficult question to be grappling with generally, splitting drinking water off from other users. I mean, I acknowledge that.
Okay, thank you, Your Honour.
Thank you. No questions from anything arising from the court's questions? None. All right, well, that's us, and you can catch your plane, hopefully.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you very much for your evidence. I certainly do appreciate, despite the rigour of the cross-examination, exactly where you were trying to take this. So, you know, that hasn't been lost on the court, what it was that you were trying to achieve. So, and so the evidence has been really helpful. So thank you.
Appreciate that.
Okay, all right, so that's us. Through to 9:30 tomorrow with your witness, Ms. Williams. Thank you.
All rise.